Hi everyone, I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about how diabetes is linked to bacteria invading the colon. New research from Georgia State University. And I'll explain why that's important and what we can do to change that. Also, one of the biggest problems as you age, meaning over the age of 27, because right now the latest statistics show you're actually aging, getting old. At 27, our arteries, as our arteries stiffen, hard, clog, are damaged, then it's a flip of a coin each day whether or not that can cause a heart attack or a stroke. So, good news from Boston University School of Medicine, healthy arteries are possible with aging. Also, new research on vitamin C. In fact, what's really fun is looking at research that's coming out today as revolutionary and brand new and never before told about how vitamin C intravenous can help with different conditions. Think of the thousands upon thousands of people in this audience who came by the Tri-State Healing Center and would regularly get 100 to 200,000 milligrams of intravenous vitamin C and how it helped eliminate and remove hepatitis B, hepatitis C, HIV, infections. 1,200 people I personally work with AIDS-related diseases, and I ask for volunteers. 12 of those people, 12 out of 1,200, went on an aggressive program, meaning 5 days a week. They were not charged, and they reversed their AIDS completely, HIV positive and negative, all their diseases gone. And Tony Brown at Tony Brown Journal on PBS had them on. You would have thought that would have gotten someone's attention. It did in the black community. That's always light years ahead of the Caucasian community, the academic community, the medical community, and the media community in knowing the truth of anything. So everywhere that you would go in the United States and talk about AIDS and talk about treatments, they would be informed and talk. Everybody else? No. Taking AZT and dying like flies. Anyhow, it was all about that vitamin C. So today, I'll tell you about what they're saying about vitamin C helping with sepsis and saving lives. Wow. Well, that's 30 years late, but it's okay. Also today, my guest in the second part of our program will be Professor Justin McDaniel. We have a lot of young people listening to this program, people under 35, the millennials. The issues they're facing are not necessarily the same as their parents or grandparents. And so I wanted to start incorporating more themes that are specific to younger people. Today, existential despair and living deliberately. Why is that important? Because those are topics that young people are really interested in. My guest is from Harvard. He also is the chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania and chair of the Undergraduate Studies. And he got a degree from Harvard Divinity School, another degree and a doctorate from Harvard Department of Sanskrit and Indian Studies. He also has learned Buddhism, so we should have an interesting conversation. Also, a brief, very brief comment by Chris Hedges from TruthDig, the artist as prophet. And I wanted to share a little additional material today to keep us focused on it, of why when we are listening to a group of individuals, think tank experts, foundation experts, and the major media, both left and right, saying why we should engage in regime change, why these are dangers, dangerous to their own population, and we should bring freedom and justice and democracy to Libya, to Syria, to Yemen, to the Ukraine, to Honduras. Well, what if I told you that we have proof now, and I will share that proof today from Max Blumenthal, one of the most uncompromising journalists in the world. And Max is going to tell you about a PR firm that's lobbying for regime change in Syria and other places, and they're the ones who can put together a rally of thousands of people in no time at all, and you think it's just the people protesting. It isn't. Everything from the slogans on their signs, where they protest, who the speakers are, it's all orchestrated by the deep state. And today I thought I would go a little further. I have a lot of knowledge on Libya, and I'm really distressed by the idea that some people who are highly respected within the liberal community continue to support the legitimacy of regime change in Libya and in Syria but never once look at the depth of scholarship that exists to tell you about both countries and what they were before we engaged in regime change, and did they represent a real or existential threat to the United States or their neighbors. So on a regular basis, I'm going to be giving you some in-depth scholarship about the countries, their rulers, and how we the United States, our CIA, all of our departments and our intelligence apparatus and the Pentagon, have intentionally and with malice aforethought engaged in destroying them. So why would people calling themselves liberal or on the left or even progressive, why would they not be able to see this? So I'm going to talk about that. So we always begin with health and healing, and diabetes is literally an epidemic in the United States, as is mind disease. We have so many brain conditions today that are not properly diagnosed, memory loss, dementia, beginning dementia, which is almost never properly diagnosed. You only really get a diagnosis when you're advanced into multiple sclerosis, into Parkinson's, into Alzheimer's. Then you get the diagnosis. For every person that's diagnosed with a brain dysfunction, you got 15 people behind them who haven't been yet put into that. So we're looking at over, I'm guesstimating right now, 50 to 75 million Americans who have something wrong with their brains. And that's going to double in the next 10 years. We have no system in the United States for handling this. And if you don't think it's a problem, then you should have been with me on Sunday when I was helping counsel just three people over a four-hour period who were in their 40s or 50s taking care of their moms or dads who have lost their brain. I mean, one woman was talking about how she knew it was time to put her mom in a home when her mom didn't recognize her, would go out in the middle of the night and not know where she was. And suddenly, you know, the police would be called and she'd have to go and get her mom. And yet there'd be times in the daytime where she would be clear. She would recognize her daughter. And then, who are you? Why are you here? I'm your daughter. I don't recognize you. You're a stranger. Get out of my house. One woman was actually carrying on a conversation with a fire extinguisher in her house. Well, that's bizarre. That'll freak you out. That's not anything. Nobody wants to see their mom or dad talking to a fire extinguisher. Kathy Griffith, that I would believe. What she did, man, oh, man. Who exactly are you representing, Ms. Griffin, when you are taking a mock-severed head of the President of the United States? I can understand the president being tone-deaf. He is. But do you realize what kind of insult that is to Mr. Pearl, the reporter for, I don't know, it was the Wall Street Journal, one of the papers, who was beheaded, and all the other people who are beheaded by Islamic extremists? That's not something you do unless you think it through and you ask yourself, what is the likely outcome? Now there's a whole word going around. It's called liberal fascism. Well, as someone who supports many liberal causes, I do not want those who are true liberals, who truly care for people, the planet and animals and the sentient beings and life, to be any way mocked, ridiculed, or brushed with a stroke of those who are self-serving, opportunist, dim-witted comedians, and I stretch that term to include you. It's not art. It's not funny. It's degrading, debasing. You're an embarrassment. And if you think that somehow you're going to get cheers from everyone who's progressive, no, you're not. Just like the people do not get cheers when they stop someone that they disagree with from lecturing. I may disagree with a human being, but I absolutely respect their right to have their opinion, and then it's my right to challenge it. And in a civil society, we engage in open debate. We don't boycott someone to throw them off the air. We don't throw bricks through windows. We don't go over and hit one of the women speaker in the mouth and then cover our actions by saying how somehow we represent free speech. No, you represent anarchy when you do that. And anarchists have no constructive place within a civil society. Everywhere they go, they are intemperate. They do not consider the actions that they have as being meaningful upon other people. They're showboating. If they're really that brave, let them come out and debate. Let them come up on a stage or get in line and challenge the person. You have every right to do that. I'm so sick of people saying that they can do something because they're protecting the public interest from bad people and they don't want our society or our college students' minds polluted. So you simply repress and prevent free speech. If you want to see someone really who has no meaningful conversation to share, no constructive conversation, then let them talk because they will destroy themselves. I've said it multiple times. You don't have to do a thing against this president. He will destroy himself. He is incapable of reason, incapable of literacy, incapable of history, incapable of being sensitive to the needs of all people. He's incapable of understanding the role of our input upon the environment. So you don't have to do anything. He will absolutely not be in office in 2 years. But if you put all your energy, including in the most vile and repulsive manner, in trying to get him out of office, then what exactly have you done that is constructive to all the issues that we have that are not being addressed? Then what are you doing to feed those 18 million hungry children each day? What are you doing to help unload the burden of debt upon the students? What are you doing for those people who are afraid to go to the hospital because they can't afford the copay? What are you doing to bring civility back into the school system and literacy back into the curriculum? What exactly are you doing when you're throwing something through a window or torching a car from a stranger that you have no knowledge of, as if that won't impact someone? What are you doing to try to bring back trees that are carbon sinks that hold in the carbon dioxide into the forest? What are you doing to try to protect indigenous cultures from the destruction of their way of life? What are you doing to challenge against genetically engineered food and mandatory vaccines that have no science justifying their use? What are you doing to reverse Citizens United? Nothing. If you think that animus, hate, bigotry, violence is somehow has a proper place in a real civil society, then you're delusional and a coward. Debate the people you're against. But preventing someone from saying what they believe, if you're going to do it to conservatives, then it's going to be done to liberals. And then who's going to protect the person who has the right ideas and can save the environment, save children, de-ghettoize America? Who's going to be there to protect them and their rights? So I think that Ms. Gifford, Kathy Gifford, is not in and of itself the problem. I believe she is only an extension of a problem of an entire group of people who have nothing constructive to share about society and simply are using their rage, anger, their ideology, no different than people in other countries that use their rage and anger against other religion, ethnicities, other groups, all for the destruction of that society. Just wanted to share that because I was repulsed in the extreme. In any case, back to the issue. So here we have people who are literally not able to function, including people I know and have known my whole life. So we have, I believe, a moral obligation to do all that we can to let people know what choices they make now will definitely have an impact in the future. The trouble is, we do not know when in the future, if they do not take good advice and good care of themselves, they will manifest these problems. There's no two people that's going to have the same. But it is going to happen. So you're looking at diabetes, which in itself is an inflammatory condition, which does lead to a dementia and Alzheimer's, heart attack and stroke. So we better learn to get this thing under control. And this is from Georgia State University. Now, first of all, if you hear the word diabetes or prediabetes or metabolic disease, it's all the same. We're talking particularly about type 2 diabetes and its correlation with having bacteria, good bacteria or bad bacteria, that penetrate the mucus lining of the colon. Now, according to this study that was done at Georgia State University, the findings which provide insight on how people develop insulin resistance-associated conditions, which is merely an abnormal blood glucose level, was published in the journal Cellular and Molecular Gastroenterology and Hepatology. So metabolic syndrome is the term for a group of factors that raise a person's risk of heart disease and other health problems, like a stroke. And such risk factors include a large waistline, a high triglyceride level, and that's a type of fat found in the blood, low HDL, which is the good cholesterol, having high blood pressure, and high fasting blood sugar level. So metabolic syndrome, which has become far more common due to the rise in obesity or being overweight, and there is no such thing as being healthy and overweight. It is not humanly possible. And anyone who says, oh, you know, you can be healthy and overweight, no, you can't. Because I can take you on a very detailed tour of your immune system, the pressure upon your heart. Remember, your heart doesn't grow in relationship to your body mass index. And also the stress upon your blood pressure, circulation, the liver's capacity and the kidney's capacity to filter the toxins. All this means that if you're overweight, you're simply going to die sooner. And we don't want that. We want you to live a long life. So when you alter, quote, alterations in bacteria have been associated with metabolic disease, including obesity and type 2 diabetes. So what's this mean? It means that if you have good bacteria, meaning you're eating good foods, good plant-based diet, taking in some good probiotics, that's all good. You create good bacteria. That good bacteria is in the billions and trillions. That bacteria actually communicates with bacteria in the body. It also communicates with your brain. So if you have good bacteria from a good diet, then you're going to be less susceptible to the consequences of metabolic syndrome. If, on the other hand, you have bad bacteria by drinking alcohol, eating sugars, having meat, then that bad bacteria makes you more susceptible to extenuating circumstances from these conditions. And that's one of the first things I do when I'm counseling anybody, put them on a detox program to cleanse the body and then to help the body rejuvenate. And that makes all the difference in the world and can help people reverse diabetes along with exercising every day as well. We know that the arteries are important. The trouble is people never know, well, what's going on in your arteries? Well, Boston University School of Medicine did some study. It was published in the peer-reviewed journal Hypertension, which is the Journal of the American Heart Association. And having the blood vessels of a healthy 20-year-old into your 70s or even 80s is entirely possible. So first we dispel a myth. Excuse me, that myth is the older you get, the more damage to all your cells. Some of these cells cannot be reversed in their damage. It's inevitable then that that becomes your weak link. That's why we don't die just all at once. One system of the body dies because it is most damaged, and therefore if it's your heart or kidneys or liver or lungs or brain, then as that system is damaged beyond repair, then your body begins to shut down. So Now we know we can reverse brain aging, we can reverse heart aging, we can reverse kidney and liver aging and lung aging. So those are no longer absolute truths. So then we come to our arteries. And the question is, how can I, if I'm a baby boomer, meaning between 45 and 70, one, how can I have young arteries, young veins? It's not that difficult. Quote, for the most part, it's not genetic factors that stiffen the body's network of blood vessels during aging. In fact, it is lifestyle, which is the leading culprit. So, quote, vascular aging is thought to be of normal aging. As people get older, their arteries become stiffer and they develop high blood pressure. In fact, that's what's happening to most people, but it doesn't have to be that way, end quote. So they took 3,196 people over the age of 50 who had been in the Framingham HARP study, and these people had what was known as vascular aging. And they found that by getting these people to exercise, to lower their body fat index, what is called body mass index, to start to lower their cholesterol, their triglycerides, their C-reactive protein, which you can do with diet and exercise, that they were far less likely to have a development of cardiovascular disease. Quote, Western culture that includes poor diet and sedentary lifestyles is a hurdle for maintaining healthy blood vessels. Age-associated high blood pressure, for example, is not common in indigenous hunter-gatherer populations. So here's the takeaway message. If you get up out of that chair and start exercising twice a day for 45 minutes, if you switch over, even over time, which is fine, to a plant-based diet, healthy, organic, non-GMO food, lots of nuts like walnuts, and pine nuts, and Brazil nuts, pistachios, they're all good. By having lots of healthy oil, coconut oil, and also olive oil and flaxseed oil, hemp oil, that's good. By having your protein comes from your beans and grains and nuts and seeds, sunflower seeds, pumpkin seeds, sesame seeds, then you can rejuvenate your arteries. Now, I'm not even talking about vitamins and minerals right now, just lifestyle, diet, and exercise. And suddenly after a year or two, you've got arteries that are 30 or 40 years younger than your chronological age. And therefore, you don't have to worry about getting up in that morning and having a heart attack or stroke because you're drinking juices, you're having beet juice, you're having cabbage juice, you're having apple juice and eating apples, grapefruit, which are terrific, a lemon, apple cider vinegar each morning. You're doing the right thing. And when you do the right thing, you get some really positive outcomes. So that's the latest on health and nutrition. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you from all over the world. This is the number one radio program on the planet for progressive-minded people. We take on the issues from a different point of view. We are not liberal. We are not conservative. We're not right. We're not left. We're not using a religion or an ideology. We're simply looking for the truth. Wherever the truth is, we're going to find it, we're going to use it, and we're going to share it. It's that simple. So I'm very concerned, as many of you are, that we're not looking at who are some of the people that we should be bringing in to discussions of what we can do individually and collectively to start making positive changes. Example, start changing your diet, as I just mentioned. That's a radical concept. That's radical progressivism. Because to go from a meat-based diet, Think of the consequences to the animal, to its suffering, and also to the health consequences. There are hundreds of studies in the peer-reviewed literature about how chicken, fish, meat, pork contribute to estrogen imbalance, leading to breast cancer, prostate cancer, endometrial cancer, colorectal cancer, and also it's displacing healthier foods that have vitalism, high fiber, phytonutrients, polyphenols, antioxidants. Meat has none of that. So just that step alone means that you're more likely then to be conscious about buying things that are local and organic, and that you're helping a local farmer. You're helping a local person. You're helping a person maintain a part of America's heritage of being close to the land, whether they're selling you some vegetables. Going to a farmer's market is a wonderful experience. It's a radical concept because you're not going into a box store and getting something that may have been grown in Mexico or Chile or South Africa or out in California and then having thousands of miles that it's traveling to get you, which raises the carbon footprint because of all the pollution from planes, trains, buses, or however it got to you. So all that is a part of making a simple change in your diet. And then not buying stuff you don't need and giving things you don't need to people who could use them. And there are a lot of people out there who are deserving, the vast majority are deserving, caring people if they just don't have the same circumstance working on their behalf that you happen to be benefited from. So if we have a gift in life, I believe we have a spiritual, moral responsibility to give that gift to others. What is the value of any gift if you can't give it away? And especially the smile that's on someone's face where you give them something, weren't expecting it, and the joy in your heart that you did it because you did it for the right reasons. You didn't do it as a political statement. You didn't do it, you know, out of self-pity, or you did it because it's an extension of who you are. Now, who are some of the people in our society that we should be bringing in to get their counsel? Those who look at life differently. They see solutions that the other persons might not see. They tend to be fearless. They're not afraid of personal criticism because they're more fearful of keeping silent and not opening themselves up to their own truths or universal truths as they see it. When you look around at the people who are frequently now demanding attention, more often than not, it is political radicals who are not always looking at all the consequences of their actions. They're not measured. They're not deep comprehensivist. They're frequently coming from some form of inner frustration, as legitimate as that may be, frustrated by the corruption, the inequality, which that exists. But it doesn't mean because you're frustrated, because you're angry, because you see something that you have a solution that is what should be done. I believe that we should be looking for the wise men and women in our society. And who are they? Well, according to Chris Hedges, they are the artist. And I would certainly agree with that. Why? Because right now I'm seeing this deep malaise, this rage in feelings of betrayal that have enveloped American society and are rarely captured and almost never explained coherently by the press. Ask yourself, when was the last time the New York Times, CNN, MSNBC had a philosopher on, someone who was not there based upon their politic, how left or right leaning they were, but rather because they saw all human beings as being sacred, and therefore the solution had to include everyone, not just one group. Hence the notion of, I'm right, everyone else is wrong. The philosopher's looking at, how can we all benefit from a solution? To grasp the savage economic and emotional costs of deindustrialization, the destruction of our democratic institutions, the dark undercurrent of nihilistic violence that sees us beset with mass shootings, the attraction of opiates, the rise of the military state, the concentration of national wealth in a tiny cabal of corrupt bankers and corporations. It is necessary to turn to a handful of poets, writers, and artists. These artists who often exist outside of the mainstream culture. And as Chris Hedges says, these are unheeded prophets. What, quote, what Kierkegaard, Dostoevsky, Nietzsche, and other prophets have in common is a strong ethical outlook and a heightened sensitivity to attitudes and morals, the obvious ones as well as those that lurk beneath the surface. They also share urgency. Prophets are not inclined to wait for the right time. Their prophetic vision demands action, leaving little room for calculation and diplomacy. Truth for the prophets is not merely a belief, but a moral imperative that compels them to speak and act with little regard for convenience or gains. But prophets need to do more than speaking and acting. It is not enough to be apocalyptic. Something must be brought forward. All depositors, all these megalomaniacs, including our own, make war on culture. They seek to manipulate or erase historical memory. This assault on memory is a philosophical assault on the truth of what we should be focusing on. That said, before we go to our guests, which we'll do in just a moment, I want to share a short piece from John White from Counterpunch, a publication I have a great deal of respect for. Quote, on October 20, 2011, Libya's Gaddafi was brutally murdered by a mob of NATO-backed so-called rebels after first being beaten and violated in the most barbaric fashion. History leaves no doubt that not only was the Libyan leader murdered on this day, but Libya itself was murdered. The regime change crew who dominate Western governments have a long indictment sheet against their names. Since 9/11, they have wrought havoc and human misery on a grand scale in their determination to reshape and own a world that has never been theirs to own. Afghanistan, Libya, Iraq, Syria, currently embroiled in a pitiless conflict for its survival as a secular non-sectarian state. This is the miserable legacy of nations which speak the language of democracy while practicing the politics of domination. Of the aforementioned victims of Western imperialism, there is a strong argument to be made that Libya's destruction constitutes an especially grievous crime. After all, in 2010, the year before it experienced its revolution, the United Nations Development Program considered Libya a high development country in the Middle East and North Africa. In concrete terms, this status translated to a literacy rate of 88.4%, a life expectancy of 74.5 years, gender equality, and various other positive indications. In addition, Libya enjoyed a 4.2% economic growth and could boast that it had zero debt. Not a penny did it owe. No national debt, no state debt, nothing. And yet it had assets in excess of $150 billion in gold alone. Now, just for a moment, please hear me out. What this means is that Libya had a higher literacy rate than the United States, Great Britain, and France, and Italy, the very countries that would destroy it. It had a longer life expectancy than the United States. It had almost no infant mortality. We are amongst the highest infant mortality in the world. We have so much debt that we're completely bankrupt. I've gone over the figures numerous times. I've gone over the nearly $20 trillion in just federal debt, but that does not include state debt, corporate debt, personal debt, home mortgage debt, car debt, student loan debt, credit card debt, of which all told, including unfunded or underfunded entitlements, bring it to over $170 trillion. With a gross domestic product of 18, we are the most debted nation ever. We are three times more in debt than as a percentage of our gross domestic product to our debt as Greece. You know, we're standing on the moral high ground and beating our chest like, look at us, we're so exceptional. No, you are a bankrupt totalitarian state, friend, run by oligarchs and people who think because they came from the best and brightest schools that somehow they are supposed to be deferred to in all matters. And yet here was little Libya, who had all this going for it. In fact, there is no current government in Libya, and hence it's a completely failed state. the three competing authorities in over 200 different factions, all terrorist, vying for power. And the internationally recognized government is the government of national accord, and there are others fighting it nonstop. So the impact of the chaos that has engulfed the country since Gaddafi was overthrown and murdered can be measured by the flood of Libyans who have attempted the perilous journey across the Mediterranean with the objective of reaching Europe. In the process, untold thousands have perished. The United Nations Security Council Resolution 1973, passed in March 2011, marked the end of the Arab Spring and the beginning of the Arab Winter. The mass and popular demonstrations that succeeded in toppling Tunisia's dictator Ben Ali and in Egypt Mubarak were not replicated in Libya. Instead, in Benghazi, where the anti-Qaddafi movement was centered, Islamists predominated. So what you were told by even liberal radio hosts, as well as the entire neocon movement in Washington, was that Qaddafi was moving on his own citizens in Benghazi to put them down. That was a lie. Now, here's something that is engaging in cognitive dissonance. If you do not trust the CIA and the national security apparatus because it lies nonstop about everything, why would you suddenly believe everything it said unquestionably, even when you have the economic resources to send reporters and researchers to a country to see, are you being lied to, because you then become the propagandist? You have a moral imperative to get your facts straight. I don't care if you say that an apple's better than an orange. If you're wrong, no one dies. But when you give credence, when you give credibility on the left to regime change in Libya and Syria, then you also must be held accountable for the tens of thousands dead in Libya, the hundreds of thousands dead in Syria, and the fact that you bought a lie from the beginning. Now, either you're incorrigibly stupid, in which case then I have to question other things you've done, or you're fully aware that you are simply carrying a particular propaganda. Is it because of who funds you? What is the meaning? We don't know that. That's the big missing. But all I know is that virtually everything we were told in the United States and the world media about the justification for regime change in Syria and Libya is wrong, and we can prove it and have, because declassified emails prove beyond any doubt that what took place in Libya was a monstrous crime for which those responsible have yet to be held accountable. And I believe those in the media who promote these should be held accountable. So we actually have emails that from WikiLeaks that were Hillary Clinton's emails, and that talked about the intention to establish a gold-backed currency to compete with the euro and the dollar as the international reserve currency in Africa was the reason they had to get rid of Libya. So, what don't you know about Libya? And for those who promoted destabilization and no-fly zones, and when you do a no-fly zone, you're going in for the kill. Because what you're saying is, we're not going to allow anyone on the ground to get into an airplane, but we're going to have jets flying thousands upon tens of thousands of missions, and we're going to destroy everything in there, including the people who are in power. And that's what they did. You got to understand something about Qaddafi. And you start by going back to Qaddafi's Green Book, written between 1976 and 79, which was based upon the direct people power, not simply parliament and not simply Western democracy, which he felt was corrupted, meaning dealing with the economy through socialist reform and programs, and what he called the Third International Theory. Now, the Third International Theory of democracy doesn't rely upon parliament or political parties, but on people's congresses and people's committees. People's congresses voted for the people's committees, who then elect the people to the state committees. In Qaddafi's view, the representative parliamentarian system of party and party politics served as its own kind of dictatorship because it represents its own kind of ruling minority over and above the entire population. And throughout Libya, you had hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people who were members of committees, and they decided what they wanted and they ruled. Put another way, we have never in our entire experience as a country had the type of democratic input that Libya had. It was far more democratic, far more fair. More people had more input than ever before in our history. We have a two-party, duopoly, corrupt system, and that's how it works. He didn't. And he believed that management of governance was transferred to the populace with the idea that Libyans should have control over themselves. Quote, I'm quoting from his Green Book, "The only means of people's democracy are the people's congresses. Any other system of government is undemocratic. All existing world systems of government are undemocratic. If they do not adhere to the method of governance, people's congresses are the ultimate goal of the movement of people on the path to democracy. People's congresses and people's committees represent the end result of the people's struggle for democracy." So in many respects, Gaddafi's political theory and what was put into practice was simply anti-hierarchical. So he was opposed to these dictatorships as they were. And he also believed in freedom of speech. He was against the Muslim Brotherhood. He was against Sharia law. He was against Wahhabism, which is the major form of terrorism today in the world. He believed in permitting free speech. He wrote, quote, "A human being as an individual should have the freedom of expression, and even if that person, he or she, is mad, they should have the right to freely express their madness." He also said, "A person who expresses himself or herself is only representing themselves." And so, imagine that. So that's part of what you didn't know. Also, he proposed that the 360 state-owned enterprises be privatized through the government, and that revenues go directly into accounts of the average Libyan. So anytime they sold oil, everybody got percentage of that oil. He also was an intelligence asset to the CIA and M16, passing information on extreme Islamic terrorists so they could fight them in their war on terror. In fact, here's a cable from 2009. Quote, "Libya has acted as a critical ally in United States counterterrorism efforts and is considered one of our primary partners in combating the flow of foreign fighters." The cable emphasized U.S.-Libya, quote, "strategic partnership in this field has been highly beneficial to both partners." And just separately, all electricity in Libya was free. There was no interest loans. You could get a loan, no interest. Owning a home is a human right in Libya. Gaddafi vowed that he would not have a home nor his parents have a home till every other Libyan had a home, so he and his parents lived in a tent. At the time of his removal, Libya had no debt and over $150 billion in assets. And if you couldn't get a job, he would pay you every year what you would have gotten had you been working. So, and he also carried out the world's largest irrigation project, known as the Great Man-Made River Project, to provide water, clean, healthy water, to over 180 million Africans. Now, here's the question. If you had been told all this about Libya, that it did not represent a threat, that it was the most prosperous state in country in Africa, of 54 countries, and had the longest life expectancy, the highest literacy rate, the most freedom from women of any Muslim country in the world, more democracy than Israel, would you have still then gotten behind popular left-wing radio hosts that said, yeah, we should go in there, and having guests on that were nothing more than propagandists for the neocon belief that we should engage in regime change to a sovereign country? What if you would have known that this war had nothing to do with democracy, but had everything to do with keeping Libya on the U.S. gold, the dollar, as a reserve currency instead of the gold denier? Just want to share that with you. Now let's go over to my guest, who has been patiently standing by. I want to thank you for your patience there, but I wanted to get this out. I had given the bio earlier to Professor Justin McDaniel. Nice to have you with us today, Justin.
Oh, nice to be here. Thank you.
Justin, you're teaching a couple of courses, University of Pennsylvania Department of Religion, and that have become extremely popular, and neither of them would we immediately expect to attract this kind of attention with the younger generation. And I thought about this, and I thought, well, it's very telling about something unfolding or occurring within the younger millennial generation and younger adults that goes largely unnoticed. And I want to focus on this aspect. I might also add for our listeners that both of these courses are experiential and not simply book learning, memorization, or passing exams. They're intended to create an atmosphere whereby students can immerse themselves experimentally into the subject matter. And one is the course on existential despair, which is very distinct with the more common clinical psychological despair. So would you begin, please, by letting us know why you believe the students are coming into your class to learn about existential despair?
Sure. That's a great question. Yeah, they've been surprisingly popular, and I have long waiting lists for both existential despair and then my other course, Living Deliberately. I also teach standard classes like Intro to Buddhism and courses on death and the afterlife and, you know, and history of religions. But these two courses in particular have become quite sought after, and it's strange because they're both quite difficult. The existential despair course is, you know, eight hours long in a stretch, and students have to, you know, read in silence for 4.5 hours of that. And then we have intense discussions and things like that. So it's a very long class, 4 p.m. to midnight. So it's surprising that students want to take a course like this. I was talking with the dean and then people in counseling services at the University of Pennsylvania and the head of the Integrated Studies Program. And, you know, and I've pilot tested the course with a few students over the years. And, you know, our big concern was the number or the high suicide rate at the University of Pennsylvania and all really colleges. This is not University of Pennsylvania's necessary problem. I mean, we're not higher than others, but it's certainly a problem. And many of the students who have committed suicide are really, you know, come from, you know, healthy families and seemingly doing well in school, are involved in athletics and clubs. And so it seemed odd. So that was one of the concerns. And another one of the concerns was just the pressure that I've heard students are under to both, you know, get a job eventually and develop skills and to pay off oftentimes a massive amount of student loan debt. But also they feel that over the course of their 4 years, they don't have a chance to learn or reflect because they're always at meetings or, you know, preparing for tests. Or, you know, participating in activities or going on to job fairs. And they actually thought college would be a time to think and reflect, and they find that it's not. And so I think the motivation for many of them, and many of them have directly told me this, is that they want a course where, in a sense, they get to be with a professor and with their peers, allowing themselves to feel complex emotions, talk about them, reflect seriously on literature and memoirs without the pressure to necessarily, as you said, memorize material, pass material on a test, analyze texts, just a chance, in a sense, to experience, you know, raw emotion in a safe environment. And I'm hoping that I'm providing that. And even though I teach in the Department of Religious Studies, this is completely secular. We don't promote any one particular religion or any one, worldview. And I have students that are, you know, some are very religious, whether they're Jewish, Christian, or Hindu, or Muslim, and some that are completely secular. But they all seem to, in a sense, be longing for meaning in life and purpose in their life that they're not finding in their courses and they're not finding in their preparations for careers.
Thank you. I appreciate that overview. Some might say that all of us have undergone existential despair, and it's a fundamental part of the human struggle. Indeed, It was existential despair that led Siddhartha to go on his journey to become the Buddha after penetrating into the depths of the underlying suffering associated with the impermanence of the human condition. And my generation, the baby boomers, we didn't think about the end of things. We didn't realize that life and all things, relationships and everything we possess and prize in life has an expiration date. I believe younger people do. I believe that life and circumstances and chaos and has brought them face to face with this. And it reminds me of the humorous saying, shoot for the moon. Even if you miss, you've participated in the random meaninglessness of the universe. And in my own work, I observe a deep existential despair among climatologists and people who really make the effort to look at all of the data and association concerning climate change and global warming. And for a growing number of them, the sixth extinction is not simply a hypothesis, but an inevitable point of human extinction in the foreseeable future. So please explain existential despair. And then in your teaching and in interactions with students and young adults, what are the more common concerns and fears and anxieties they share that can be related to existential despair?
That's a difficult task, but I'll try. So we're approaching in my class existential despair with a basic notion of the realization that usually happens, when you're between, say, 14 and 22, 23, that you exist, and that you exist as an entity that can make decisions and that can affect the world. And most importantly, you realize at that age, this is the time that you stop seeing yourself as an extension of your parents, you stop seeing yourself as an extension of just your circumstances or as a student or as a member of a sports team, but you see yourself as being able to, make your own decisions within reason. But what comes with that also is the realization that you could kill yourself and that, largely no one could stop you. You could get away with that. And also the realization that you could hurt someone else, that you have the physical power now to end a life. We send people to be soldiers at 18, that we have, you can own a gun, shockingly, as a teenager. And so that students, young people across the board feel a great deal of responsibility, a great deal of loneliness, a great deal of fear. This is all coming, at a very kind of time when their body is changing and they're having to, start to be able to think about making money and about getting their own apartment, all of these things. And at the same time, in a sense, they are faced with the knowledge that they are not free. So they're physically free. They can make their own decisions, but they're really caught in a web of obligation and expectations. And this is particularly difficult, I think, with students like at the University of Pennsylvania, where you have students that are very high achieving. I think we only accept 6% or 8% of the students who apply. So it's a very competitive Ivy League school. These are students that generally have been high achieving. They're not necessarily wealthy. I think that's a misconception about many Ivy League schools. Many of the students are not. But many are not. But they have, in a sense, they've achieved in their life. They've had a lot of pressure on their life. They've had a lot of expectations put on them. They've been valedictorians. They've been presidents of their classes. They've, have talent in music or in sports or all of these things. And just the time they're realizing they have freedom to make decisions, they also are realizing the expectations that are being put on them, that they are paying an exorbitant amount of tuition. It'll be about, $60,000 a year for each one of them. A lot of them get loans and scholarships and things like that, but it's an exorbitant amount of money. So they have the expectations to live up to that. They have the expectations to, in a sense, experience things to make this the best 4 years of their life, or that they should be traveling, they should be reading, they should be experiencing, but they don't have time because they have jobs and they have classes and they have clubs and all of these things. And so they have this mixture of the excitement of being alive, the excitement of coming into adulthood, and then all of the weight and expectations of that. And it is in a kind of despair of, what do I do with my existence? Do I become a well-meaning and well-behaved and well-curated kind of follower of others and living up to expectations of parents and, future, bosses and things like this? Or do I take advantage of my youth, and do I rebel, and do I innovate, and do I create, and do I do things that are artistic? Do I question authority? Do I question politics? And so you have this competing notion of what it means to be alive and what means to have a purposeful or, you know, kind of deliberate life. And so that's what we mean by this existential despair being caught in this. And then in a sense, you know, what, how are the students experience this? I think they don't know themselves. And they consistently come to me and come to other professors, and they want their life, in a sense, to be meaningful, they said. They want to get the most out of life, and they use a lot of these vague kind of statements. And, you know, we empathize and we sympathize, but at the same time, we're supposed to be telling them how to get a job and how to get the next scholarship and how to get an internship. But when we really want to be able to say is that, listen, go sit down and read this novel, or you need to take a walk in the woods. And so we're caught in this tension as well.
Do you have any thoughts on how people who undergo bouts of existential despair can get past it or emerge out of it with a renewed sense of purpose and commitment to living?
I do. At least this is what, at least in my experience and what my students have taught me over the time, the most, in a sense, successful students, not necessarily successful in terms of money, but many of them are, were in jobs, but many of them are. But in terms that they feel in a sense of purpose and they feel a sense of belonging, are students generally who, in a sense, prioritize, is that they, instead of spreading themselves too thin by being on the internet and following every news story or listening to all the newest music that comes out or knowing about every sport, all of these things, instead of these students who try to be incredibly well-informed and engaged, the students who seem most successful are the ones that pick, they, in a sense, understand that their life needs a balance, that they need a creative outlet. So students who spend their time working on something creative, whether it's making music, poetry, writing novels, art, something like this, that it might be not be their career, it might not be their job. It could even be cooking, or could even be, you know, things like sculpture, or could be something in engineering, making machines. But they have a creative outlet that sustains them, that it doesn't matter what politics come along, it doesn't matter what the weather is, it doesn't matter what their friends are doing, that they have something that they feel committed to, and they feel that is wonderful because it's not necessary, that it is not for something else. It is purely for the act of creation. It could be turned into something else, like making a film or making, you know, inventing a new, you know, app or something like that. It could lead to something, but that's not the point of it. It's like music or cooking, is that you don't get to the end of it. You don't, you know, John Coltrane didn't come one day, come along and say, you know, I'm done playing saxophone. I've achieved everything I can. I'm just going to quit now. He played and he played and he played, and he was constantly innovating. You don't have a great chef who one day says, well, I can never replicate that great meal again, so I'm not going to cook anymore. Of course, they're always going to innovate. So students, in a sense, the ones that I feel the most content, have that aspect in their life. And they, you know, have a job and they do well in their classes and all those other things, but they have that. And then not only do they have that, they also have, in a sense, a period every day of doing nothing. And this is, sounds strange for high-functioning students or students that are paying a lot of tuition. But they have 15 minutes or half hour, even an hour a day, of actually doing nothing, taking a walk, reflecting, strolling around a museum. And I'm not talking, you know, these are busy students that they don't have a lot of time, but taking that little bit of time out, it doesn't have to be meditation. It doesn't have to be something religious. It can be simply just what we would call wasting time. Not social, not as part of a program, not as part of a class, simply time just to allow the mind to wander and to wonder. And those two kind of aspects, I find, if students incorporate those into their life, and again, it doesn't take too much time, say, you know, hour and 2 hours, 3 hours a day at the most, that those are the students who seem to have a very healthy attitudes to balancing that sense of wanting freedom and experiencing experience and understanding that they have obligations and expectations.
Clearly, Justin, you're providing him with a lot of important tools that the standard academic approach would not provide. And I thank you for that. And also the books, The Lovelorn Ghost and The Magic Monk, as well as Architects of Buddhist Leisure. I appreciate being on and sharing your insights with us today.
Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
Professor Justin McDaniel from Philadelphia on that in the University of Pennsylvania. I'm Gary Knoll. I want to thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. And Sunday, 9 o'clock, 5th Avenue and 90th Street. You want to get yourself in shape, come to the park. We got a lot of coaches there to help you, and I'll be there. And it's free. It's public service. Have a nice day.